Sound One Right and beginning the visit with Suge and Fanny this Friday night, the 25th of February, 72. Channel One Right and beginning the visit with Suge and Fanny this Friday night, the 25th of February, 72. Channel One Right and beginning the visit with Suge and Fanny this Friday night after supper, the 25th of February, 72. Channel One Right, beginning the visit with Suge and Fanny this Friday night, 25th of February, 72.
And then we sold,
When you undid the boat.
Yeah. It smelled like. And then we sold duck for making these cotton sacks, things like that. And all of it had a peculiar odor, each one. Calico didn't smell like, the duck or bed ticking, and all of them had a different smell.
Did people make their own cotton bags?
Oh, yeah.
And they were long.
Long? Well, they usually 6 and 8 feet. They dragged the ground. They'd hold 100 pounds or more of cotton sometimes. So that's about as much they'd drag, and they'd bring it in and weigh it and empty the sack into a wagon or into a bin that they had there, and then they'd go back and put another 100 pounds in.
But they buy the...
There's no trouble for a good cotton picker to pick 200 pounds a day. Some of them pick more than that.
But they made the thing that goes over their neck.
Oh, yeah, they had a strap over the neck. They had a strap, and then they had a sack right here by the side of it, and they fixed those straps in such a way that mouth was open all the time, see, so he put the cotton in it good.
Yeah, and then it went 6 or 8 feet behind them.
That's
as they
right.
Went down the road.
They drag it. As it went along.
But the ladies made those in the home.
Oh, yeah.
I just never had, we didn't come up in cotton country, so I didn't know. I thought you'd buy them.
Now,
the
you
store.
All sold the...
Sold a duck to make it out of. 8-ounce duck, 10-ounce duck. And we sold bed ticking. Everybody made their own bed ticking back that time, you know.
Sure.
And they'd either have a straw tick, or a straw tick was a lighter bed ticking. And then if you had feathers, oh yeah, you had to have a very close woven, a heavier material to retain the feathers.
And feathers stick right through it, right?
Oh yeah, that's right.
And they did many times.
Oh!
And for pillows too, the same thing for pillows. And we sold everything. I can see the old store now, those red shelves that we painted. This was the new store, not the old one, but after the other one burned. And we had our, as you went in the front door on the left side, you'd see all these boat goods, particularly ginghams and calicoes that
you
they made the dresses out of. And it used to be those big Mother Hubbards that take 9 and 10 yards.
Sure.
That's right. We sold 9 and 10 yards to make a woman's dress.
And they weren't only they weren't always pregnant. they were women that just wore them.
That's right.
That's right. You covered up.
Yeah.
In your time.
Yeah.
In your time.
Oh yeah.
Well, you could almost tell what the material was in the dark, couldn't you, by the way it smelled.
Well, yeah, you could. If it's new, of course, it's wash time too. Well, that'd take that out of there. It's sizing that goes in it largely, I imagine. They call it sizing. Make the stiffness of it, you know.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that, but you know I can smell muslin. I can smell bacal right now.
Yeah.
As a different smell from
that's right. And we had some linens too. Of course, they didn't smell much. Not like the others. Different kind of smell. And then we had a case of ribbons. You know, you people used to have lots of ribbons on their hair.
Mm-hmm.
We had a case for that. We have little narrow ones, and then have some go 4 inches wide. Different colors, taffetas. And there's in the old store on the other side, there was a showcase that had perfumes in it and some jewelry in it.
Oh, you didn't say a perfume.
Well,
in
we
a
certainly did. We
store.
Certainly did. Ours wasn't a grocery store.
Well, what was it?
It was a complete store. I mean complete.
It was an emporium.
Emporium is right. The drug department is on the right as you went in.
Morning and pouring.
And in the drugstore, we handled everything that the doctor wanted. We had morphine, we had chloroform, we had iodoform, And that was the proud place, you know, to kill off the old dead place, the old farm was. We had podophyllin, that was rougher than calomel to take.
And what was it?
Podophyllin. Things you never heard of, I guess.
No,
and then
never
we had plenty of Epsom salts, of course. And sulfur, we had that in buckets, 30 pound
and
pail.
You used to eat that
pound.
Right
I
out
used
of
to eat it right out of the pail.
He loved the taste of sulfur.
Uh-huh. And then we had copperas, bluestone, they call it.
What did you have sulfur for?
Oh, sulfur for cattle and for human beings. They mix sulfur and molasses, you know. And what this sulfur was used for this 7-year itch too, along with something
yes.
else. I really, I don't know, they took it, sulfur and molasses, though that was a sort of a tonic, you know, like sassafras tea in the spring.
Didn't sulfur give it a sort of sickly smell?
But yeah, it come through your perspiration, you could smell it.
Oh,
that way.
Oh, really?
You could tell them that took it, huh?
You could tell them that took it, right.
Sugar drink, that sour milk.
And then we had two-bit axes, you know, or double-bit axes and a single-bit axes. We had them without handles or with handles.
Did you have
cross-cut
weight,
saws?
Pounds,
oh, yes.
Pounds?
Yeah, we started from 4 pounds, went up to about 7 pounds. And then we had these old tie hackers, broad axes, they called them. About that wide, and they'd come back, and then the head would be up there, you see. It took a man to swing one of those.
Yeah.
The tie hackers would use them. And that was a big industry in the country store for a good while.
Yeah.
We bought up ties and sold them.
Let me tell you a story about Cookie. He'd been getting these two jobs at one time and three jobs, and he was at the hospital down there. Laura works there, you know. And he got on as a... Well, anyhow, he swept, and I said, Cookie, that must be pretty simple, right? Get one of those big, wide brooms and just walk and speak to anyone you see. He says, broom's all right with that mop. And he says, you don't push that, you fling it.
Oh.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's all right. But you know, it wasn't all right, because... He brought that up a number of times after that, and he'd say this, he's over here at the station now. I'd say, you got some pretty good exercise there. Yes, but not like that mop.
We're talking about the cleaning too. In the first store we had, the old wooden store, we'd sprinkle the floor, you know, with a sprinkler, and then brush it out, sweep it out. And of course we'd take this duster, feather duster, and just stir the dust up, move it from one place to the other. And once a year, when we took inventory,
yeah.
we would really clean this thing out. We'd get all the dust and everything with rags and stuff like that. Just once a year, that was about all the clean it actually got.
Yeah.
And we'd take a few yards off of the dirty cloth, you know, and sell those in little packages, just a whole lot of different remnants, you know, in order
faded
to get
faded and dusty.
Uh-huh.
They both
faded. That's
right.
Mm-hmm. The light would fade a lot of in the cloth. Then we had horseshoe nails, you know, and horseshoes. And
now that duster, I remember the duster.
Yeah,
feather
duster.
Dust.
Yeah.
It would
just stir the dust up, move it from one place to another. That's all it was doing. Then when we got the concrete floor, we used a sawdust, you see, and mixed a little oil with that to keep down the dust, and it worked more effectively than the other. It was better. It didn't have near as much dust in the other.
Did you have a safe to keep your what'd you do with your drugs?
And all our drugs were just left in the open.
You mean morphine and everything?
Yeah,
was just left
there? And everywhere broken in for that. We had one or two little break-ins. I stayed in the store to keep the thieves away. I had a cot down there. I guess I'd have run pretty fast if one come in, but
I
didn't think so. I had a .22 rifle in there, you know, I was a big man. Oh, I was in my teens then. And after my teens, I'd gone to university, I went to high school, and I was 18 when I got through there. And I came back and stayed in the store probably after that.
How much stuff did you have that you had to dip? You know, you sold lard by the...
We sold lard by the people bring in the camp in there.
No, you didn't.
Oh, yes. They would bring in these little syrup cans, gallon cans.
Yeah.
And we'd give them 5 pounds of lard.
No, I never saw that.
Oh, we did that. We took a great big spoon and out of a lard barrel. We bought the lard in barrels. And later on, we bought them in smaller containers.
Yeah, that's nice.
But we bought them to start with in barrels. And we bought vinegar in barrels, and that vinegar would eat right through concrete where it would drip up. Just eat a hole through it. And sorghum, of course, we had that in barrels too, till it gets the sugar, it wouldn't come through. But most times, sorghum was in cans. I think I told you about this Jim Howard that worked a racket with us on those cans. We get these cans of sorghum. They had no label on them or anything. And he'd come in with a can just like it, see, and bring a dozen eggs maybe in. But when he went to leave, he'd pick up the sorghum can instead of his can that didn't have any eggs in it. He'd swap cans with us, you see. He was quite a character. He lived about 200 yards from the store. He didn't marry until he was up about 40 years old or more. And he'd always had a hacking cough. And he read medicine, and that son of a gun was smart as he could be. And he'd tell the doctors more than they could tell him. But he was a hypochondriac. He thought there's something wrong with him all the time.
Yeah.
And old Charlie Preston was a great big old 225-pounder that had been just busting everybody open on this old wrestling, you know. They'd get out and wrestle on Saturdays. That's part of the sports. And they'd wrestle either Indian hug or side hold. And so... he kept teasing Jim Howard about wrestling with him. And Jim wrestled with him one day and threw him. And the fellow that was supposed to have been sick all that time. And he would do anything in the world to beat somebody. One day he sold some cotton to Dad. And Dad would figure up how much the cotton was worth, you know, and give him a check for it or give him the money for it. And he was in a hurry and he was working out a whole lot on that day. And he worked out some for Jim Howard. And Jim took it and took off, just like a beeline. Dad looked at his figure and he saw he'd given him too much money. And he called him before he got across the branch down there at about 100 yards from the store. If he hadn't, he'd never gotten it, see. Then, getting around to characters that way, old Squire Greer, he had been a JP over in the edge of Hardin County for a long, long time. And he started in with us. He worked a little on Saturdays and during rush time. And then he got to where he was the weigher down at the gym. And that was a man that everybody had to have confidence in, and they did have confidence in him. Then his son Elmer Greer came along, and Dad trained him up. And Squire died while I was still back there. But he was a man that nobody ever said anything against. He was just a gentleman in every respect. Now, his son was a little bit different kind of fellow. He was honest and just fine as he'd be that way. But he liked the girls, and he got along pretty well with them. And he liked the sporty clothes and fine horse, you know, and buggy. And he was a man about town, a man out of the country, anyway. But one of the first things he did when, after he got started working for Dad, we would do our own work, you know, and putting up a gin or a store or anything like that. Sometimes we'd have contractor. We had a contractor on the store, but on gin we didn't have a contractor. And we called him Mose, Elmer Greer. And he got to mixing some lime up, and the darn stuff exploded and took one of his eyes. And he was one-eyed all after that. Well, he and Troy were partners for a long time in the country store there. And in the gin too. But I say partners, he worked for Troy. And then he wanted to be a partner, and Troy decided he didn't want to, and then he left, and Troy never did get over that. And he did a real good job and had a real good business. And later on, he bought the place there, the old home place that we had.
Well, after Troy died, he did take the store.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
He took the bill in there.
But didn't he run a store?
I don't think he ran a store. He had a store not
too
far away from
it. He had another store somewhere.
He just used his warehouse.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why did that store go down?
Oh.
After Troy died, it just quit.
That's right.
Didn't it?
Well, Claire ran them off.
Yeah.
She did. Wasn't any question about it. She had funny ideas. She had a chance to sell it, but she thought she could do better running it herself.
You had to know how to run a country store.
Absolutely.
You just couldn't go
you
in there.
You had to get along with people. And getting along with country people is a lot different to town people, too. Everybody knows everybody else and everything he thinks. He knows about it.
Well, now, is it still run like that?
No. Even back then, they were starting to go to town a lot. The biggest part of the trading now is in the bigger centers.
Oh, yes.
They go to Corinth, Mississippi, which is only about 14 miles away.
So all they do is...
get in the car now and go.
They
buy the things they have to have right quick there. And also, in the stores like Greer has over there now, the sharecroppers have to have something in the summer on credit.
Yeah.
We used to, about 1 year out of five, we'd collect and have a real good profitable year. But the other 3 or 4 years, we were carrying them on the books. And we'd start in the beginning of the year, we had what to call a McCaskey register. Everybody had a place to put the little bills in there. And what you'd do, you'd go and see what his bill was up to date, you know, and then you'd put on his new one there and stick that card right in there and even give him a copy of it, which was a very good system. It was a whole lot better than the old ledger system. And when September the 1st came, they'd been trading, we'll say, ever since about January or February. We'd put on 10% for carrying it. And then the cotton would start coming in, you see, and maybe if they had a good cotton year and a good price, why, they'd pay off. If they didn't, why, they'd maybe give you a cow or a pig or two or some kind of a settlement that way or give you a note. And when the Depression came along, Dad had a whole bunch of notes and that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
I had to borrow $1,500 for him in Knoxville. At 1.5% a month to get him a little bit of operating capital to work on back there. The banks were all closed and everything, you see, is frozen. And he put up some of those notes for it, and I borrowed it for him. From Manufacturers Acceptance Corporation, Mr. Morton and Mr. Burns and Mr. Sanford.
Your first dealing in Knoxville.
Well, that's the first of any borrowing that I did that way, yeah. Yeah. Guy, one of the interesting things, a sidelight to this.
That ledger now.
Yeah.
That's right. You started out using a ledger.
Yeah. Yeah, where you put everything down on one, you give a man 3 or 4 pages in there, and just everything when it went down on there.
And then you finish the page, you can stick another page in.
Well, they just generally left 3 or 4. It wasn't a loose leaf. They'd leave enough there to take care of him.
Well, the one at Brassfield drugstore.
I was going to ask you, did you remember watching those soda jerk boys run back there and every time you charged an ice cream cone?
Yeah.
They just wrote it down, and how in the world did they ever ferret it out? At the end of the night or the day or the week or something?
Well, there's lots of mistakes made on that kind of a system.
Well, they did. They just had a big old.
They used to tell it on Dr. Petty. He had a store at Hamburg, Tennessee. He said that one year he sold a side saddle, and he forgot to whom he sold it. So he just put it down on most all the customers he had. And he says, you know, most of them paid for it.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if Alexander Pricefield did a few things like that, too.
We sold saddles, and we sold bridles, and harness, and trace chains, and what do you call those? Haim straps, of course, and trying to think about this thing that went across the back there that held up the chains on each side. I've forgotten what to call it. Anyhow, we sold that webbing to make that out of, and then they'd have a little clasp of the thing that fitted on each side, you know, to hold the chain along the side there. And the chains went up to the what are the things that went around the collar?
The breast, the shoulder.
Yeah. Well, they had a name for it. Hames, I guess. That's the hames.
Yeah.
They changed, hooked onto the hames, and the hames fit into the collar.
Yeah.
And you tied the hame string down the bottom there to hold that.
Yeah.
And they pulled it that way.
Yeah.
Well, that store wasn't any bigger than this kitchen, Mud.
That store was 30 by 80.
80. That is a little bit longer than
that's
I thought.
That's
2,400
square feet.
And it was tall. The ceiling was tall.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had stuff all up the wall.
Yeah, and then
and hanging down.
That's right. And then we had a warehouse in which we kept coffins. We sold coffins.
A ready-made ones.
Well, the way they were ready-made. The way they would come from St. Louis, St. Louis Coffin Casket Company, they'd ship them down the river. We'd go to Pittsburgh Landing and get them. Have somebody else do in a wagon. And Uncle John Donald ran the landing down there. And he'd ride about 3 miles on his bicycle back whenever he'd hear that boat whistle, you know, whoop. He'd go down there and pedal down there and get all the freight and have it put up there. He had a horse and a little dray that he used for a long time to bring it from the landing up to his warehouse. And these coffins, we'd have a great big one there that'd take care of a man, say 6'2" or something like that. Then the next one may be a 5'10", and then the next one would be maybe a 5.5 foot. They'd have 2 and 3, maybe 4, nested together, screwed together. They'd have a screw through them there to hold them that way, and that way they'd cut down the book on shipping. We'd have somebody call in about 10 o'clock at night, not call in, he'd come and knock at the door or holler hello out the outside, you know, you'd holler hello back at him. Say, well, John Jones passed away and we've got to have his coffin. So we go down, and it didn't have many to pick from, so it wasn't very hard from the side which was which. And then we dress it out. All of this metal that was on it is called white metal, and it was very cheap stuff and it would tarnish easily, and it was wrapped up very carefully. So we'd unwrap that and we'd put that rest in peace and put the handles on the side and everything on it, and they'd put it in the wagon and drive off and put him in his best clothes, and we got to where we handled a little bit of that.
You were the funeral director.
Suit with no backs or anything like that. Yeah, but
I see. You were the clothes.
We just sold
uh-huh.
clothes along
mm-hmm.
with it, too. That's where we did some of that. So we fixed a lot of them out at night that way.
You had to put the cloth inside and all that, or was?
No, we never did. We didn't. We wouldn't even go to the funeral in most of the cases.
No, I meant the cloth in the coffin.
No, it was in there.
That was in there.
That
it was outside.
There. That's right.
Oh.
If it's coffin, and then now I was talking really about the boxes that included the others. You see, we did all of the trimmings on the other part,
mm-hmm.
but the cloth was already in there with the padding and stuff.
Yeah, well, I thought you were.
Yeah. Then right outside of this place where we kept the coffins, right out on the ground was the cultivators and the harrows and all the farming implements.
They just set out.
Set out, that's right. Of course, we didn't usually stock up too much of what we could sell. Once in a while, we sold a wagon or two. We didn't keep many of those.
They set out?
Yeah. People never thought about stealing anything back in those days.
And the weather.
That's right. That's well, everybody else left it. Whenever you sold them, they still stayed out in the weather, you know. They rusted out. Practically all of the farming implements back in those days, they didn't take much care of them. Few customers would.
They
but
just
some of the
out.
Most thrifty ones, yeah. Set out in the fields. About where the fella got through with them. You pick him up there next year.
You've got a tape on that. It's not only just Florida, it was up in Tennessee too that people just left their implements where they lived.
That's the way they went. Of course, we did a lot of barter business back in those days. Chickens, eggs, possum hides, coon, mink, fox, and ginseng. We bought some ginseng roots.
Well, now that hide business. That was just a limited time of year.
That's right. Then we bought cow hides too. They'd skin them and sold them down, bring them in, you know.
What'd you do then?
We sold them to people that sent them on to be tanned for leather.
All of the hens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The way they do that, they take them and they have some kind of process, take all the hair off, you know, and they go through a tanning
process. Well, would somebody come by and buy these up?
Oh, yeah,
because these not local people.
No, the local people skinned them and brought them in.
Yeah.
And usually the people that bought the poultry would buy hides too.
The tan people.
Yeah, come out of Corinth,
mm-hmm.
Jackson, or somewhere like that, and do that.
Well, nobody would come in and buy eggs from you, would they?
Well, you mean locally? No.
So if you took in eggs, you had to use them yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But otherwise, about once a week they'd come pick them up, see.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be somebody buying every week. And we had a chicken yard out in the back, and we'd have to run those chickens up into a little house that we had and catch them for these people who's going to take them out.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite interesting, this country store business.
Mm-hmm.
I
well, now, how did you you got into that rice squash, really? And you did that all when you were just growing up.
Yeah, I used to could count eggs and run a conversation at the same time, never miss an egg.
Yeah.
You picked up three in each hand, you see, half a dozen at a time, you figure them by the dozens. And they'd bring them in great big baskets or in buckets. And then we'd put them over in a big tub. And then later on, we'd put them in cases. But we handled on Saturdays. We'd handle two or three tubfuls that way.
Yeah.
People bring them in that way. They'd count them out and put a little slip of paper in the bottom, 10 dozen. And then when they got ready to trade with them, we figured out 30 cents a dozen or 20 cents or whatever they were. And they traded out that much for them.
But you could just pick them up, count them, and go ahead with your conversation.
That's right. It's just automatic.
I don't remember, you see, the talk. Now, a lot of the talk was just passing the time of day, and they weren't interested in it.
Well, there's quite a bit of talk, especially in the wintertime when it got rough and they couldn't work and they'd come in. And we always kept a fiddle and a guitar. And there's several country boys that's pretty good on them. Old Yank Humphrey used to be the fellow that do the fiddling. He and George Browder, they were both pretty good on it. And this Howard I was talking about, Jim Howard, was good on a banjo, and we used to have a banjo too. And Dad could play an accordion pretty well, but he generally did that by himself. He didn't have to do with the others. They'd get to play in that way, you see, especially around Christmas times, and have a lot of fun that way. And then they'd get around this big old stove. We first had the stove where you put the wood in from the front end, you know, and then you had a kind of a boiler up on above that just to radiate the heat out. And then we had a place for them to spit the tobacco in, but they didn't always hit it. And around the stove was pretty smelly. That tobacco would hit that, you know, and it'd fry like everything. Yeah.
I don't remember.
And whittle, boy, there's lots of whittling going on right away.
I don't remember that boiler.
I can't see that stove either. I don't believe I saw one like that.
It's a box stove. A little longer than this.
You mean like a wood heater?
It's a wood heater. That's what it was. About so wide. But down here where the smokestack went up, it would go up, and then here was a circular thing up here. And that heat would go through that and back around and then go on up the pipe.
That's
fine. And it sure does put out the heat that way.
Is that in your first stove?
No. That was in the second.
I don't know.
I never heard of that.
Yeah.
I never heard of that system.
That's a good system.
They still work?
Sure, it would work.
You never see it anymore.
No, you don't see stoves anymore for
heating purposes. Bellies, well, you do too.
Well, a few of them you do. Yeah. Well, we had a big store, and it took a lot to heat it.
I don't see any of those, Francis. Just little wood heaters.
Most of them now either got a oil heater or a gas heater.
Sure.
Yeah.
Space heater.
Well, Charlie Woods had a pot belly.
Yeah, but they don't.
And his came up this way.
Yeah, made out of iron.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing about the country store too was the luncheons that were served there. You know, we kept canned goods. We had canned oysters and Vienna sausage and potted meat and peaches and strawberries and that was about the general run.
Do y'all keep cheese?
Yeah, we kept cheese and start off with, we had it. Oh yeah, we didn't have a refrigerator. We had one of these great big old knives, you know, we'd work that little thing on the side. That was later on in the store too. And it would get a dime's worth and you'd come down to that and cut it off and fix it that way. But the way they ate, they'd sit on the counters, you know, and eat, put a piece of paper under it, and they'd have a can of oysters and crackers.
Eat out of can.
Eat out of can, get them a bottle of Coca-Cola.
That's good eating.
Yeah, it's good eating, right. Sardines, boy, we sold lots of sardines that way.
Oh, yeah.
Fine crackers.
Yeah. And the crackers originally were all in one big box.
Mm-hmm.
And the time you got the bottom, it was getting pretty stale, you know, and cracked up.
Now, let me see. I remember the boxes, they were about a foot square.
Well, before that guy, they were that long.
Yeah.
And about that wide. And it's just rows and rows of crackers in there.
Yeah.
Didn't weigh very much.
Became a dime's worth of crackers.
Oh, you got a pound.
And,
you got a pound of crackers when you had a dime back then. That's a lot of crackers.
Yeah.
And you put them in a sack.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they were thick.
Yeah, that's right. They were thick.
Oh, yeah.
Not near as crisp as they are now.
Oh.
Heavy.
That's right.
And pretty big size.
Yeah.
They were.
Yeah.
Well. And they come in those boxes.
Yep. And later on, like you were talking about, they came in tin boxes. Square boxes and had a
lighter.
Good little top on them. It was lighter. They were better crackers, a whole lot better then. And smaller.
Yes.
Yeah.
Smaller and lighter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I can't quite place those old crackers. I've seen them in boxes, in pasteboard.
They'd have cardboards between the layers.
Yeah. I've bought them in the nickel.
Yeah, boxes.
Carton.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was back prior to that.
That's funny.
What were you doing when you fell in the lard?
Well, we had that was in the old store, and we had a lean-to on the side.
How old were you?
Oh, about 13, I imagine, 12 or 13. We kept our fishing poles up on the rafters, you see, and this lean-to on the side. And this lean-to, we kept flour, and most of the flour then was sold by the barrel, and then by 24-pound sacks and 48-pound sacks. And I kept fishing poles up on top of that, and I was up there trying to get my fishing pole down, and I got up on top of the lard barrel, you see, barefooted, and the darn top of it slipped off, and there was about that much lard in the bottom of it, and my feet were right down in it. They teased me about that the rest of my life.
That's what I always love to tell that one when the family gets together. Did you say a colo?
Oh yeah,
you know,
that was in the same side.
Yeah, I was thinking the flavors
there.
of the odors of the coal oil and the lard and the flour all in there.
The salt meat was right by the side of the scales, in a big box in the same lean-to warehouse there. Now up in the front end of the warehouse was a separate room. You were talking about the odor, and we had men's clothing in there, and we kept that real nice and kept the dust out of it. We had cloths over them. We sold lots of men's suits. And we sold tailored ones. We'd M-born tailors and some of the others. We'd measure them up, you know, and send off, get them.
Figure out the pattern?
Yeah. Figure out the pattern and whether it's full peg or half peg.
There's a lot of pride in the countryside, people wanting their clothes to look natty.
That's right. And the natty at that time was something, too. This full peg, you know, was a flare out. Around the hips, and it's narrow down around the bottom. It just made them bulgy around the hips. Full peg and half peg.
Yeah.
And double breast, single breast.
You know, a good bit of that, those things in the hamlets before my time. This fella who who his daddy was he gambled for one thing. He spent his nights in the country stores playing poker. And this boy, they sent him off to school, and he didn't go to school. He just hung around, and I don't know what he did. And he came back, and he had the first polished leather boots in that country. And he was one of them that went after this girl that Faulkner calls Eula, in that yellow wheel buggy, you know. And he was the toughest one, and he was sort of the outsider, and the others were after him. Do you remember that? And they got him one night.
Yeah, beat him up.
Broke his arm, and Varner says he reckoned he could patch up a mule. He reckoned he could patch up a man. Set his arm.
Yeah.
He fainted two or three times, and he was pretty well.
This you're talking about the gambling. The way they do that at home, they go around this old cotton gin and do that. They roll the dice and
but that
play
was
cards.
The town fellows.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
country people didn't have enough to gamble on, did they?
Not much.
Not much. Well, but you would have these countries out there, these families out in the country that were fairly well to do.
Yeah. But there weren't many of those back home that were in the gambling class. They'd trade your pants off of you.
Yeah.
But when it came to just rolling the dice or playing the cards, it wasn't a whole lot of it that I knew about that went along.
Yeah.
Some of the towns like Savannah
and
Corinth, Mississippi, and places like that, there's quite a bit went on.
Yeah.
Like you say, it wasn't enough ready cash, I guess, out in the country to do much of that.
Yeah. You know, there's so much of the things that go on that you know, I cut it out. My mind, I don't.
Yeah.
So you see, I'm ignorant. You see, they had seemed like they just had to do a good bit of that poker playing at that time.
Going back to the store part, I think I told you about this once before. I'm not sure. We had two barrels of sugar. We'd have the white sugar and we'd have the brown sugar. And they bought it 5 pounds or 10 pounds. We'd weigh it on the scales, you know. Well, that's brown sugar would come, and it got so darn hard that you couldn't stick a pick in it. And what we'd do on that, we'd take an auger and we'd bore holes all through it. And they'd pour water in it. And the next day, it would just be good granulated sugar.
Put the top on it.
It just dried out. Mm-hmm. It just dried out.
Oh.
Well, we just discovered that the hard way. And went right along with it after that. Now, the white sugar get a little hard at times, but not nearly as hard. I don't know why. The brown sugar dried out so much more than the
Did the countryside use the store and the stove or the...
Oh, that was a gossip place.
To really sand out... did they do more than just tease and kill people?
Oh, yes.
The
politics
really
was rife there all the time. And talk about things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, was it kind of a center, or you didn't, you know, I mean, it was always warm.
That's right.
In the wintertime, you could
That's
always
right.
see somebody there.
Oh, I remember old Tom Carroll, who got his arm off in the cotton gin down there. He's trying to clean it, you know, and it's still running, trying to get it unclogged, and his arm got in there and got cut off up to about there. He used to come around there, and he'd get up on the counter and sleep, you know. Take a bolt of domestic and stick it under his head and stretch out on there. Talk a while and then just take a nap up on the counter there.
Well, I mean,
well,
kicking
around
that is what I was saying.
Well, they kicked around at us some, and some of them were very opinionated, of course. We had one fella who just died 3 years ago, Will Childers.
Mm-hmm.
You knew him, so.
Mm-hmm.
That fella was a most observant man I ever saw in my life. He could go to church or just see people on the street, and he could tell you exactly what kind of clothes you had on and who you was with and all about it. But he was teeth that talk too darn much. They would say, "Are you quoting Wells Childers?" That won't go. But he was generally right. But he just kept on talking all the time. He used to do our work at Corinth, Mississippi. He would take the cotton out and sell it for us. He'd pick up the freight at Illinois Central, M&O Railroad, and bring it back. And that was an 8 hours hard work. It was more than 8 hours. He'd start in the morning. It took 4 hours in the wintertime with a team to go through that mud. That's for the gravel road days, to get 4 bales of cotton to Corinth to sell them. And then he would spend that time selling the cotton and then picking up the freight at the different places and go around to wholesale grocery and pick up some stuff. He'd have a wagon load of stuff when he'd come in, and it was usually 6 to 8 o'clock at night in the winter time when he'd be coming back. That was that old, what they call, ball knob dirt. And when you go through it with a wagon, that darn stuff would just be all over those wheels, or it was just a big mass of mud revolving. And it would really pull down 2 good mules. They'd be worn out when the day's over. But he was quite a man in observing things that way, and quite a talker and quite a gossiper. But he did have powers of observation.
But you can't remember, really, any sessions of people coming in and
I can't remember the things that they talked about much, except, of course, they talked about women. They talked about the church, Sunday school, and the schools, and children's days, and we had a Memorial Sunday there every third Sunday in June, and then there'd be certain picnics, 6th and 7th of April down at Shiloh. They'd discuss things like that, and then they'd be discussing about trades that had been made, a farm had been sold, and about a fellow they'd get an argument about the lines where the property was, things of that kind. They weren't too heavy thinkers as far as the government knows concerned. I remember this fellow Copeland that was a blacksmith there. He kept up with the First World War. That's about the best you ever saw. He got maps and everything, and he knew exactly where the Hindenburg line was and all those others, and he just, day by day, he read it and kept up with it and was full of it all the time. He was a blacksmith.
You know, the intellectual interest where they are self-educated is amazing.
Yeah, that's right.
That's amazing. Gosh, I'd love to see that now. You see, it's clear out. It doesn't exist anymore, does it?
I don't know. I guess it does in spots, guy. But it doesn't come to surface much.
Yeah. Well, I've sort of reconstructed some parts of it, but nothing like this, what you saw about it. You see, the overview is so comprehensive. Now, I can just pick up things like the pranks that they did. Ms. Guthrie has been my great source of the pranks.
Yeah.
Oh, she just dearly loves them.
Mm-hmm.
And this fellow, White Heyman, oh, that's a long story. And, she was out the mailbox one day, and here he come in his truck, and he had this bull, and he stopped to show it to her. And he said, he got a pedigree that long. And she kept that straight face, she said, he looked at her and says, "You go to the devil." Just, you see, just then, he had, on holidays and cold days and before Christmas, he'd come along after the paper man and bring the paper in about 5 o'clock in the morning and rattle all the doors to where they all had to get up.
Yeah.
And she thought that was something, you know. And she says, I sure do miss it.
You know, that's when Shug's family get together, and they all they talk about are, is what happened to somebody or some prank, and they just laugh. You know, they'll it's all
never happened,
yeah. It's never any more than that, really.
During Christmas time, we used to have real battles with these Roman cannons.
Yeah,
the 20 shooters and 30 shooters.
Yeah.
And we had a doctor around there, Charlie Chambers, who killed one man. And when he was drinking, he was just poison. When he wasn't drinking, he's just the salt of the earth. I guess his work had something to do with it. And he maybe took that as his way of getting a little release from it. But he was running me pretty heavy one time. And he was running Joe Kahn. That's when he got his worst lick. He's running Joe Kahn, and Joe just turned and let him have a Roman candle, and he hit him right on the eye. It hit his eye, just put it out and burned him real good. Things like that, you know.
Rough
is right.
Reckless.
That's right. And we used to, Dad always would get one of these paper balloons, and on Christmas Eve, usually, after everything happened in the store and he was ready to close up, a dark night, they'd get that balloon out. And what it was, I guess, gasoline or kerosene probably, matted stuff. And they'd pull this paper away from it and set that afire, and those fumes inflate this real thin paper thing. And about one out of three, you'd get it burned up trying to get it fixed up. And then it'd go up in the air, and they'd find out the next day where it got to. That those things float 7, 8, 10 miles.
I never heard of them.
Yeah. Well, that's a regular part of it. And we used to have firecrackers up to 14 inches long before they outlawed them. They got them down now to over 2 or 3 inches. We put one in the ground, you know, out there, and set it fire and roll and leave it, and it just blow that ground up. They were dangerous.
I never heard of a firecracker that big.
They had them.
That's what they talk about. The great things they did that were real dangerous. Rough. And they just laugh about somebody get hit in the top of the head with that thing, you know. And everybody just rears back and laughs about what a good joke it was that old Joe so-and-so fell over fence and broke his leg. Ha, 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 that bull was coming right after him. Roman Cannon hit him upside the head and his hair on fire. Ha, 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 ha. They just had the best time. Why, they're the roughest people I ever heard about.
Part of the celebration at Christmas, too, was the shooting of the anvil.
Now, we did that when the war was over. That's the only time I ever heard
of
that.
You take a solid piece of iron,
and
then you take a sledgehammer and take the handle out of it. You fill that little thing full of powder in there, and leave a little powder out to the side of it coming out, and put an anvil on top of it. Then you take a long rod or a long pole and then have a iron on the end of it and heat that to where it's red hot, you know, and you get back behind a little something, touch that off with that over there, and boom, you could hear it for miles.
That was
part of the celebration every Christmas.
And that was...
A Christmas?
Yeah, that's Christmas. That's the only time. Oh, 4th of July, I never did have any fireworks. It was all Christmas.
When did you ever hear an anvil shot?
Francis, I don't know that I ever heard it, but I have heard this, just the saying, the anvil shooting anvil.
You know you heard it. You heard it at the end of the war. And I'm going to ask you which woman in town took that long thing, and I can see her coming out of Brooks's garage right now with where the blacksmith had it red hot. And she came out and they had it right out there between... in the middle of the street, and she casually came out and touched that thing, and that anvil went off. I don't know. It was I think it was somebody whose son, and I think it must have been Miss Jones. Herbert's the only one I know that got killed overseas. I think it was Miss Jones. That it was a woman, though. And I was sure you remember that.
That's
the only anvil I ever heard go off, but it was quite an occasion. But I can't believe people just did it every Christmas.
One time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they shoot 4, 5, 6 times at night.
Oh, yeah. Gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. You hear them all around different places.
Oh, in the countryside.
Yeah, Christmas Eve night.
And they were,
Well, you know, people weren't so ambitious, in a way. Enterprise.
Well, they couldn't get in the car and run off somewhere else. There wasn't any cars.
No.
Well, who would see the anvil? Just your daddy go out and do this, or who?
No, the blacksmith usually did it.
Well, where
and
was he?
And two or three of the friends. He used to have a blacksmith shop just across the road from the store was, about 100 yards, 150
well,
yards.
Well, would people gather around him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they'd go out there and help him.
And he had a good blacksmith, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he always had a good blacksmith there. I remember one blacksmith there, Droke, and his hobby was horses. He had a real frisky mare, and then he got him a black stallion. And he and that black stallion fought to see who was going to be the master. He'd get him out there and try to make him go round and round, and couldn't get him to do it, and he'd rear up and prance, and sometimes he'd try to paw him. He'd knock that doggone horse down, flat down, hit him upside the head with a stick. And then he'd put those horses together in a buggy and tick off 40 miles an hour going up the road, you know, that buggy. Or he'd ride him. He never did let that horse get the best of him. But it was a fight to see who was going to be the master. And he'd get right out in front of his house to do it.
You all were just savages.
It's all public, wasn't it?
Yeah, part of the display. And there's always one trying to outdo another. That's wrestling I was talking about. And then these tie hackers would come in on Saturdays, and they'd get a little cream ale and a little bit of moonshine and get all liquored up, you know. And they'd have to see who's the best man. And they didn't take guns, usually.
Usually.
Well, that's right, usually. But they'd get in a fist fight, and then once in a while a knife would come in play, or once in a while knucks would come in play, these brass knucks. They'd knock a man out cold. We had one fella, Andrew Farley, who was a pretty good boxer, and he was the champ. they more or less bypassed him, but every once in a while he'd get the fun of knocking one of them down. But he was accused of using brass knucks, but I don't think he did it so fast they couldn't tell if he did or not.
But that community, was it the whole county or just your community that would not stand a Negro?
That's our just in that community.
They would not let a black man or a family come in their community?
About 3 miles from there was a little black community. And they'd come over and do washing and stuff like that once in a while. But they couldn't take a regular job. The gravel road was one of the first jobs of any kind that employed quite a few people. It was about 11 miles of it or more that they put in there. And one man thought he would hire a Negro to drive his gravel team. You know, they'd have maybe 15, 20, 25 teams hauling gravel. And they rocked him off. And we decided that we'd build a store back after the other one burned, Dad did, and he said the only way he could do it was to burn a brick kiln. He couldn't afford to buy the brick already. And there was a set of Negro family over at Selmer, Tennessee, about 20 miles off, that knew how to do this. So he had to talk to the people around in the community to get them to allow them to stay there for 4 or 5 weeks to burn this brick kiln, and they stayed in our cotton gin down there.
But the odd thing about this is that this is in the heart of cotton country.
That's right.
Cotton was the biggest income
right.
that they had.
Yeah.
But this was this is a little clan of people around Shook's little country store. That's like one of these little pockets up in the mountains. They were.
It's
a different breed.
They come in there and trade, but when sundown, they left.
It's a different breed.
And they couldn't have a job. We wouldn't have thought about hiring one around the cotton gin. They'd run him off.
Get out by sundown.
Yeah. And Guy, to show you, now, down on the Shiloh National Park around the edge of it.
Which is 5 miles from there.
About 8 miles, something like that. It made a law, you know, that cattle must be dipped to get rid of ticks. Well, do you think people like that? They put a cattle vat in down there close to Uncle George Hurley's on the edge of the park. They blew it up a dynamite. When they wanted to dredge the creeks and make a canal through, they rebelled against that. Of course, that opened up a lot of good land that was being flooded out every year before. Of course, there's arguments for that and against it. They didn't get the fertilization after that of the settlings off of the floods that they had before. But it certainly did. They could have good crops for several years.
They could get the crops in a
little bit early. Yeah, well, get them in early and they could know it's not going to be flooded out. But people are just naturally that way, especially out in the country. They're against any kind of a forward move.
They were.
That's right, they were. That's right. Now it's changed the other way. Now it looks like it, anything to make it easy and take it easy and forget about paying for it.
And that really happened so fast.
Yeah. Changed.
That gravel road that employed people, I've heard them talk around here, and Fort Blanning in World War II was what just changed the face of this whole countryside.
Hmm.
You see these fellas that were trying to raise vegetables and make a little money and one thing or another, they didn't have to do that anymore. They just got on these old trucks with old Fort Blanning and come back at night and got money. And once they start making money like that, they never satisfied without it.
When they were building this road, they didn't have their camp right close to home. It was about 3 or 4 miles off. And they had some Negroes in that camp. And they'd get in a fight and kill over women. They fight that way. Old Big Alf killed another Negro up there. At Mickey, they had a regular place. And that was something that they talked about for a long, long time. I can remember seeing them put up the levee across the bottom there. That took weeks and weeks. They'd take these little two-horse scrapers, you know, and just a little dab of dirt at a time.
Yeah, half a yard.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. About a half a yard is about right. Spoonful is right. And they built this levee. I guess it was in the highest place, maybe 8-10 feet high.
Yeah.
And just barely enough room, I'd say, for two cars to pass, about all. And it took a long time to get that done. A long time to build a bridge. A
lot of hay.
Yeah, a lot of hay. A lot of money came into the country that time because of it. But a lot of it, though, was these hired crews coming in. But everybody that had a team and a wagon made some money.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. These gravel wagons would have these two-by-fours rounded out on the ends, you know. And when they got there at the place, they'd just pick up one of those two-by-fours time and let the gravel run through the bottom. That was the way that was the dump.
And the gravel wagon weren't too big, was it?
Oh, no. It was about that high, you know.
Yes.
And it was a regular width of a wagon and a regular length of one.
Yeah. It seemed like I hadn't thought about that in so long. It seemed like...
Well, you've seen gravel wagons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ones I saw weren't very big.
They were.
You
but
know,
that stuff's pretty heavy, you know.
Yes. You know, a lot of them little wagons that we used, the bed was very simple.
Yeah.
And light.
Yeah.
Well, you know, actually, you don't need heavy equipment for most of the work. And you don't need heavy animals. Just like out here, you see, I don't need a heavy tractor. If I need a heavy tractor, maybe it'd be once a year, and I could hire that.
A lot cheaper than you own one.
Yeah. And the rest of the time, you see, it's just mashing everything down.
Yeah. That's right.
The talk and all those games. You know, one thing I noticed, if you've got good food, good biscuits and good fried chicken cooked in good grease and some sweetening to go along with it, you eat that and you feel like you've eaten something.
Guy, the people back there then, they ate what they had in the gardens and what they canned. And side meat, lots of them, side meat. And gravy and sorghum.
And it's all good tasting.
Yeah, it's pretty good. That old side meat, I don't see how they took too much of that. I know I went out and stayed all night with some of these boys that's come along that way. And they'd have biscuit and gravy for breakfast. That's about it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes maybe a little sorghum. But they got along.
Yeah.
Nearly all of them had a little bit of meat when the hog killing time, you know. They'd get some sides of meat and have a ham or two. Make it last a long time.
You know, it was a treat to have chicken, wasn't it? They did about once a week.
Well, most of them depended on those eggs for barter,
yeah,
and they didn't kill many of those chickens off. They got the one that didn't lay, well, they
mm-hmm.
either sell it or they usually sold it instead of eating it. They didn't eat too many chickens. I'm talking about the people that were pretty low on the totem pole.
I can't remember any of the people who were pretty low on the totem pole.
Oh, I see. Little old shotgun houses that had stick and mud chimneys.
Yeah.
You know any of the punching floors?
No, I don't know any punching floors. But there's just little old floors on 2x6s that cracks in them.
That makes me think, how did y'all keep the animals out of your store?
Yes.
How'd you keep them little 4-footed long tail things going?
Well, once in a while mice would get in there.
I bet they
did. We weren't bothered too much of rats, but we were mice.
You have a cat?
Yeah, we have cats. And we had in the first store,
yeah,
we had a hole cut so the cat could go in and out anytime he wanted to. And that's the way we kept them down, was the cats.
Cat sleeping.
Yeah, I've got a big scar on my leg now from catching mice in the store. Guy, the mouse trap that I was using, okay, thing's empty. It was that a glass like that with a thimble stuck under the edge there, and fill it full of cheese.
Yeah.
Put it on the inside, and he'd get in there and do it.
Glass.
Yes, sir. And then I'd just slide that over onto a board, you know, and take him on the outside, and then I'd smash him.
Yeah.
I mean, you catch him alive.
Yeah, caught him alive. Caught
like
lots of them that way.
Looks like he's.
And I went down one Sunday to see about that, and I stepped up on something to reach up and get it, and that something that I stepped on happened to be a box of axes.
Oh, gosh. I just didn't hear
about
that. And
I turned that thing over, and some of the little old nails, you know, that it was when I pulled the box lid off, the nail heads were still there, and that thing got in my leg and just went down. I got a scar there about 2 or 3 inches long. Went to the bone.
Yeah.
Those axes are so heavy, you see, I just pulled it on.
Yeah.
I got my mouse, but that was kind of a good price to pay for it.
Yeah. You know, a lot of things can happen.
Yeah.
I was out here at the Farmers Exchange, a mutual, and they had a bale of these fence posts. And I took the hatchet out there. I go cut it.
Wow.
And I'm telling you, that thing flew apart so fast, it buried me.
Yeah.
It buried me.
Pulled all over you, huh?
Yes, just knocked me down. But you see, the thing of it was, it hit me so it didn't hurt me.
Huh. You're lucky.
But it could have just broken. Yeah. But I wouldn't, you know.